Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, podcast listeners, to the Absolute Return Podcast. I'm your host, Julian Klimochko. I'm joined by my co-host, Mike Kesslering, and our special guest, Kevin Brent, who is the Chief Investment Officer at Blue Sky Equities. Blue Sky Equities is a single family office and venture capital firm. We talk to Kevin about a number of investing topics, everything from venture capital investing to leverage buyouts to cryptocurrency to investing in fixed income. So I hope you enjoy our show with Kevin Brent of Blue Sky Equities. Just one point of disclosure is that Blue Sky is an investor in Accelerate. Other than that, hope you guys enjoy the show. We are live. Kevin, how are you? Thanks for coming on the Absolute Return Podcast.
Hey, nice to be here.
Great. So let's kick things off. Why don't you start out just by telling our listeners a little bit about your background, and how things came to be in terms of where you're at right now, Chief Investment Officer, how that progressed, and, you know, if someone was looking to follow the footsteps to get to that point, you know, what sort of advice would you have for that type of person?
Well,
aside from getting lucky.
The advice I always have is get lucky. Because that is a very key component of everybody's story when they are successful. But I actually got into finance a little haphazardly. A buddy of mine who is way smarter than I am wrote the first CFA exam and failed.
That's a tough one.
And so I said, you know what? I bet I can pass it.
Yeah.
And so studied, passed, got my first finance job as a mutual fund wholesaler.
Oh, right.
And then...
Smiling and dialing?
Exactly. Like, you know, 50 calls per day to advisors and brokers. And while I was completing my CFA, flipped over. I wanted to get to the buy side.
Right.
But
was that like a lifetime passion for investing, or was that sort of, you know, a newfound thing once you did CFA level one? You're like, wow, you know, I kind of like this stuff. You got to experience it selling mutual funds. And did that spark your interest in investing, or is it something that you had prior to that?
That was actually what sparked my interest in investing. Prior to that, I'd actually done sales. Mm-hmm. I sold Xerox copiers. I sold electronics at Future Shop, or Best Buy, I guess, if you have U.S. listeners. And so it was going through that I sort of learned, hey, this is finance. It's math. I'm good at math. I'm good at understanding trends and just a lot of the pieces that fit into being interested in investing, mm-hmm. I was interested in.
Right.
It was just sort of getting that exposure and then fortunately, you know, getting the right opportunities to be able to progress through, you know, the sell side, through corporate finance, where I worked at one of the major railroads in their right. corporate finance department, to, you know, getting this job at Blue Sky Equities, where I started as an investment analyst.
Right. Bottom of the rung.
Yeah, well, I was technically employee number one.
Oh, nice.
Because it's a single family office, and so mm-hmm. it was just the family who was managing everything with retail brokers.
Right.
And so I sort of came on to help professionalize and have more of an institutional framework
right.
with how they manage their portfolio, and started out, again, just analyzing their oil and gas stocks, because we're here in Calgary,
yeah.
where it was real estate and energy.
Yeah, and so those would largely be public oil and gas equities?
Yes, for the most part. Okay. You know, throw in a few midstreamers for diversification.
And in terms of what time was it? Was this, you know, like kind of in the heyday before we've had this brutal bear market in oil and gas?
It was immediately prior. So I started October 15th of 2014.
Okay, all right.
One of the very, very first things that I did actually was put together an analysis of the different options we could use in order to hedge this significant energy portfolio.
Right.
I still have it.
Very right. good
still,
timing.
Still in the spreadsheet, right? And I'm like, hey, this is how we can do it if we want to hedge with options, if we want to hedge with futures, like these are the ratios.
Right.
And you know, it was like the down case scenario. It was the December expiring options, and I had the scenarios for if it was below 75, if it was below 70, and if it was below 65. And you know, WTI as of when those options expired was below 50.
Right. So there wasn't a lot of diversification within the portfolio at that point in time.
No, not at all. And so, you know, one of the first things I did was go in, triage the portfolio, sell the names that looked like they were heading for bankruptcy or that had high debt ratios, or just, you know, we trimmed it from over 60 different energy positions down to about 20.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about how you, I guess, the family office started moving towards private investments? Did you start out as an LP in private equity and VC funds and then start doing some direct investing, or how did that progression evolve?
So it started originally with the patriarch of the family, and being involved in the energy sector in Calgary, he had access to both public but also private investment opportunities. And so it started through private investing in a sector that he knew and knew well and had the opportunity and connections to be able to get access to those deals. And so then from there, and oftentimes, you know, obviously the pattern still continues to this day where, you know, you invest in a private entity, that entity grows and eventually either goes public or gets acquired, right? It's not dissimilar to the venture capital model that exists today. And so the other side of that is when I started, the president of Blue Sky Equities was a very active angel investor.
Right.
And so he was one of the first members of the local angel group here in Calgary, had written a number of different checks into very early stage businesses. And so that was a much smaller part of the portfolio, but still a number of those investments existed and they had the familiarity with it. So I was just sort of introduced by, you know, sitting down, starting with this group, looking at this portfolio of hundreds of positions, both public and private, and researching the backstory. Okay, how did you get involved? How long have you been involved? What's it valued at now? What's the prospects like?
Yeah.
Let's review the financials and the different disclosures that we would receive. Because again, on the private side, you don't have necessarily that same quarterly audited reporting, right?
Yeah.
Some groups are great. They'll give you a monthly update, let you know what they're doing, have an ask for their investors. Others drop off the radar. Mm. Oh, we haven't heard from them for a year. And technically, that's the only legally required time that they have to provide you with information.
Right.
So
the portfolio, when you get there, it's largely, you know, public oil and gas equities, some real estate, and then this, you know, portfolio of, say, startup angel investments like that. How did that develop over time? You indicated paring down the oil and gas portfolio. Was there a strategy with respect to further diversifying and becoming more VC-like instead of just a oil and gas and real estate family office?
Yeah, definitely. To talk specifically to the sort of VC and side of the portfolio is, prior to my involvement, the model was the family would write a bigger check, take a fairly significant ownership stake, often a seat on the board, be fairly active in not necessarily the operations of the business, but the strategy and the guidance and everything else along those lines.
Right.
However, the problem with very early stage, like angel stage or seed stage venture capital, is you have you don't have a great win ratio. Oftentimes, these businesses, whether they fail or they have to pivot, the direction that they thought they were going to go changes, they require more capital. And when these businesses are stressed, it's a lot more time, effort, and energy from a board member than it is from a passive investor.
Mm-hmm. You can see all your time being spent on the losers and literally no time being spent on the winners, where from a personal time allocation, I could see that being an issue.
Well, that, and when you have a more material stake in the business, if all of a sudden they can't make payroll next Friday, well, you have a lot more of an incentive or a requirement to throw good money after bad in order to try and salvage that original investment. And so then all of a sudden your six figures turns into seven, and then, you know, you've really got to salvage it. Right. So what we wound up doing is pivoting the model. There's a group down in the US called 500 Startups, and their model was to take more of a portfolio approach.
Right.
Write, you know, 500 checks. I think now they're up to definitely over 1,000.
Got to change the name.
Yeah, exactly. but basically it's that it's extremely difficult at that early stage in order to determine what's going to be a success, what's going to be a failure,
right.
You know, the pedigree of the founders, the idea, all that kind of stuff. So yeah. You just write a whole bunch of checks and allow your big wins to offset the losses.
Yeah.
And so we wound up pivoting to that model. And so now from an angel stage, we write very small checks, at least to start. Kind of like the Warren Buffett's model pre the internet, when if you want to get the financial statements of a company, you had to own one share.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we kind of do the same thing on the private market.
It's like a tracking position.
Yeah, exactly. Just small, it's a call option on their future growth.
Right.
And so we've now written checks into 70 different early stage companies with the intention to follow on in later rounds if their business plan pans out in the way that was anticipated. So the successful companies, we'll follow on for their Series A continue to provide capital, basically doubling down on our winners, even though oftentimes it's more like a 4 or 5x down on the winners.
But. Right, yeah. And speaking of that, you know, you've taken a look at, well, I'm sure much more than 70, invested in 70, probably looking at opportunities every day. What are you looking at these days, and what really intrigues you in terms of, you know, growth, seed stage investing opportunities?
So, I mean, there's all kinds of different opportunities that are out there. I mean, a few that are exciting is productivity software.
Okay.
So everyone is looking to be more productive. The trend from COVID and work from home has really been upping the productivity of businesses, right? B2B SaaS, you know, obviously a crowded space, but if there are groups that are able to materially increase the productivity of employees or assets, that's very easy to sell. It's very easy to see the value that's being created,
right.
As opposed to a lot of B2C consumer-facing products where you're like, well, that's a nice to have. And maybe a lot of people would say this is nice to have, but I find that a lot more difficult to get a lot of the insight into the key performance indicators, but, you know, like the things like your cost of customer acquisition,
yep.
your margins and all that kind of stuff. So. That's one area. There was a pitch I saw today that was really cool. It was home ownership as a service. And so it's basically looking at these extremely expensive markets in Toronto, Vancouver, New York, San Francisco, London, and coming up with a co-ownership model so that millennials are able to get equity in property without having to go the traditional route of having a significant down payment and getting a mortgage and everything else along those lines. So it's kind of like rent to own.
Or is it like fractional ownership?
Well, yes, it is fractional ownership, but let's be honest, like, who has a mortgage here? We all have fractional ownership, right?
Right.
In some way, shape, or form.
Right.
It's just now, instead of being split between you and the bank, it's split between you, other investors who are also going to share in the appreciation or depreciation of your property,
right? And they're your roommates as well.
Yeah, well, it's their model is looking at condos.
Okay.
So it's basically if you were going to rent a one bedroom, instead put down a little bit and buy. And you can't see the air quotes here, but you build equity with your rent in this case.
Right. Perhaps it could integrate into Airbnb or something of that nature.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're not there, and that's one of the things that's happened in a lot of major cities, they are restricting Airbnb rentals to only the primary occupants.
Right.
So all of a sudden, if you go and you have a bunch of investors who are running ghost hotels, well, now they can't do that anymore. So this is a way that they would be able to still get have some type of co-ownership opportunity, but there's still a primary occupant that's in there.
So it's almost a two-sided marketplace where you're fulfilling a need, a home for capital, as well as me, say perhaps me being the renter, where I'm able to get some equity in a home, as well, I assume, there would be some synergies in terms of the cost of capital, right? In terms of the debt financing, as opposed to myself going to the bank, I would assume I'm able to get a lower cost of debt in terms of mortgage rate.
Well,
on
the way that model works is that it's not actually the occupant that needs to get the debt, so they don't need to qualify for the debt or the mortgage. So people who wouldn't necessarily qualify for a traditional mortgage for a $500,000 condo in one of these expensive areas can still qualify because it's institutional backers that have the 97.5% ownership of the condo. So
yeah, you're seeing a lot of new business models, specifically in real estate. This week we saw Open Door go public through a special purpose acquisition company. We've seen Zillow do a bit of a pivot where, you know, they're actually offering this home buying, iBuying service, which is interesting in and of itself. So a lot of innovation happening in, you know, all these different sectors.
I'll give a shout out to one of our investee companies, Honest Door, which is in out of Edmonton, that is doing, not real time, but monthly property valuations through data harvesting of, you know, the city assessments, local trends, everything else along those lines. And they've just opened up BC as of this week. And so now, anybody in Vancouver or Kelowna or whatnot can see not just what their neighbor's property is assessed at, but what they think it would actually sell for.
Right. So that's similar to what Zillow was doing in the US with their Z estimate or whatever they
exactly
call it.
Yeah.
That makes sense. So speaking of, you know, all these changes during COVID, and really, I mean, how did that affect your due diligence process? Obviously, travel has been pretty restricted, and, you know, visiting offices when a lot of people started working from home. Were there any major changes for how you operate in terms of evaluating new investments?
I mean, not really, aside from not having face-to-face meetings and doing them on Zoom. For the most part, you know, data rooms still exist and are shared digitally. It's not in the technology or software space, you don't necessarily go and verify existing assets in the same way that you might with, you know, a mine or a manufacturing facility.
Yeah, or a hotel or something.
Or something along those lines. So, you know, we're still having the conversations digitally or virtually with all of the founders and everything else, but I haven't really found that the workflow has been that impeded.
Right.
You know, there might be some complaints in regards to being able to look somebody in the eyes right across the table and read people's expressions and the minutia of how they act in order to gauge someone's character. But part of the reason that we write very small checks, at least for these early stage investments, is so that if it does go to zero, if the guy turns out to not be quite the personality that we had thought, then it's just sort of part of that loss ratio, right? And is that something that I would have detected if we were sitting face to face anyway?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I'd like to think so, but there's lots of high functioning sociopaths that are out there searching for investment.
Yeah, and certainly. And with respect to your model, you know, investing in asset light startups with basically mostly intangible assets, you know, actually physically visiting the office or, you know, wherever they're at, probably isn't as big of a deal as in other industries, obviously. So that makes sense.
If they have an office at all and they're not all working from home.
Yeah, exactly, or some sort of remote spread out workforce, which is becoming more and more popular these days. Pivoting to another area that was popular a few years ago, coming back to life with a lot of different innovative business models would be cryptocurrency. I know you're big into the space a number of years ago. What are your thoughts on cryptocurrency these days and a lot of the changes? What I find interesting is this whole DeFi movement and the notion of lending within the crypto space, which is really something that's kind of growing now. But yeah, what are your thoughts on, say, you know, Bitcoin and any other happenings in the cryptocurrency space?
Well, I mean, the only thing that we're currently involved in is we have a long position in Bitcoin.
Okay.
I've actually found a fair bit of the deal flow has dried up. And part of that is, you know, the decentralized finance movement, great for consumers, great for users, terrible for investors, because the whole point is to cut out all of the middlemen are scraping basis points. But those, if that is your model, and the whole point is to decentralize it, well then, you know, if you are purchasing the stock of a corporation, then that's the whole point is to not make money, but to free you from all of these entities that do make money off of you.
Institutional lenders, they're trying to cut them out.
Exactly. And so it's difficult from, you know, again, an investor standpoint. And so, I mean, I've been saying for a while that the real big opening up of this is going to be when people can interact with the blockchain without realizing that they're interacting with the blockchain.
Right.
Right. Still to this day, there's too much terminal access, right? Like an easy app.
Right.
They exist now to buy and sell various cryptocurrencies. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the more advanced facilities that a lot of these decentralized finance applications want to do, you still, you know, need to understand how to code a smart contract, or at least audit it, or et cetera.
Yeah,
right.
You need to be very technically proficient to be able to be comfortable with that aspect.
And the whole aspect of broad adoption and truly decentralizing finance requires broad adoption, which means your grandmother needs to be able to borrow, you know, Tether instead of USD or whatever it is that you're looking to do. So, I think it's exciting. It's going to take a while, like a lot of emerging technologies, right? Like if you look again at all of the hype that stemmed from the internet, which easily took 10 years to mature and is still maturing.
Yeah, exactly. And even go back 20 years ago when there's good internet infrastructure, however, you got to be crazy to put your credit card information and, you know, think that it won't get stolen. Now, these days, you don't think twice with respect to ordering something on Amazon or eBay or even some website that isn't nearly as popular. You just put in your credit card details and that's fine, right? So it really took a long time for that trust to develop. And that's how I kind of see, you know, Bitcoin and different applications developing. Bitcoin has been out there for about 10 years and still a lot of people still skeptical. But each year that it is out there without controversy and continues to work as it's supposed to, like the internet, it just continues to grow, establish that credibility, and then more and more people sort of get comfortable with it and are open to utilizing it. So speaking of that, you mentioned holding Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about the internet is that it took a centralized protocol.
Right.
In order to get everything on the internet to be able to communicate with each other seamlessly, right? And that decentralized protocol was basically a layer upon which all the users and hardware were able to connect and all of the creators and software were able to communicate to them, right? We don't have that in the cryptocurrency space or the blockchain space, right? We've still got a number of competing infrastructure layers and oftentimes they are unable or it's incredibly difficult for them to communicate between them. And so, you know, that'll be one of the aspects of the killer app, right? Is whenever all of these different groups can agree upon something. And because it's almost an anti-commercialization movement. The web was a commercialization movement. Everyone wants to make money off of this. So
there's a libertarian bent, right, to the crypto side. It attracts libertarians by nature, which don't want that centralization, right?
Exactly. And so, you know, it's interesting to think without that sort of profit motive, it's a lot more difficult for all of these disparate groups to be able to, you know, come up with an agreed upon framework.
Right. Yeah. Where you require that consensus, it's really hard to, you know, further develop things within that sort of framework. The Bitcoin blockchain is kind of set and making any sort of modifications, you have all these weird forks and things of that nature. So it has its positives and its negatives in the way that infrastructure was set up. But one thing that I find fascinating is the institutionalization in terms of ownership of specifically Bitcoin. We see the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, which is the publicly traded GBTC, roughly $4 to $5 billion worth in that, which is a significant portion of the outstanding Bitcoin currency. And another very interesting move that we saw recently was a corporation called MicroStrategy. They're publicly traded. They put about $400 to $500 million of their balance sheet into Bitcoin because they're uncomfortable holding fiat currency. They're, you know, they weren't liking all the fiscal and monetary stimulus happening worldwide, and they're highly concerned about potential hyperinflation. And they very clearly outlined their thesis with respect to holding Bitcoin. And so I think more and more institutional investors, as we go on, they'll become more comfortable and start making those allocations. You guys are long. We'd like to hear, you know, your thesis with respect to being long of Bitcoin here.
Well, I mean, it does come down to the reflation or inflation trade, right?
Right.
And, you know, Bitcoin, like gold, is only a hedge against your fiat currency, your local currency, right? And I know, I'll start almost with a counter argument that Japan has been printing money for years and years.
And, 30 years, yeah.
Yeah, has not been able to create inflation despite their central bank owning, you know, 70% of the bond market. I don't know if that's the exact amount, but you know, an incredibly large amount.
Even equity ETFs now that they're buying.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Right? And so there's a few different trends that are a little bit worrisome and that are changing that I think could actually create more inflation in the future as opposed to what's happened in the past. You've got this reshoring of manufacturing with the quote-unquote trade war between the US and China. If you wind up having to, because there's been a long-term disinflationary effect of being able to use lower income countries for labor and production in order to manufacture goods for less,
right,
which is disinflationary. The second thing, which we haven't quite seen yet, I thought we were gonna see a turn here with COVID, but it hasn't happened, is venture capital, massive venture capital firms that are subsidizing new products.
Well, this is SoftBank's Vision Fund.
Right. And that are allowing these companies to operate at massive losses because they're not earning the returns that are required in order to be profitable. Well, that's disinflationary, right? If Uber isn't turning a profit, it's because they aren't charging enough.
Yeah, exactly. We're getting very cheap rides.
Exactly. And so the trend's currently continuing, you know, and I'm kind of involved in that by, you know, helping early stage companies that are currently operating at a profit and providing them, you know, with money to increase their revenue, even though they're burning cash.
Right.
But on the flip side, once you get to a certain level of scale, that cannot continue.
Right. But what I find fascinating is that in the current environment, if we look at, you know, what stocks are doing well, for example, the Snowflake IPO just yesterday, they're growing massively, but losing a ton of money on the bottom line. And investors just between the last public round, private round 6 months ago, and where the public equity is trading now, one day after the IPO, it's up 5x. So clearly public equity investors, it's not just VCs, are willing to subsidize these new growth firms in order for them to grow their businesses.
Which you know, I guess goes back to the state of primary versus secondary markets and providing capital, right? So when we're investing in venture capital, it's always on the primary side. It's going into treasury in order to fund that company.
Not taking out shareholders.
Yeah. Exactly. Meaning no one's selling their shares to you guys.
Exactly, right? Versus, all transactions that occur on a stock exchange, like if you're doing your discount brokerage, are all secondary.
Yeah. Oh, except Tesla with their $5 billion at the market offer.
Of course. And you do have secondary offerings.
Yeah.
And companies can raise capital, you know, through investment banks,
right,
et cetera. It happens. Don't get me wrong. But for the most part, retail investors are not participating in that.
Right.
In IPOs or the secondary offerings, right? They just don't get access to it. So they have to buy once the stock is free trading. And so if there's limited demand, you've got this order book of institutional investors that are gonna, you know, maybe put an ask in for double. Well, guess what it's gonna trade at, right?
Right, yeah, for sure.
And so if you have purchasers that aren't discerning, price discerning or value discerning.
Central banks, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And lots of cheap capital, then things can definitely get bid up, right? Yeah.
Or say a SoftBank Vision Fund, they seem to be wanting to pay top dollar. If we look at what happened with WeWork and some other startups that they got involved with that didn't turn out too well, they ended up paying, you know, basically too high valuation.
Yeah. So I mean, like right now, this, you know, last 6 months of performance in the stock market has almost entirely come from large cap growth.
Oh, for sure.
And so that makes me think maybe I should start checking out some small cap value.
Right.
And try and get ahead of any type of reversal on the large cap growth.
For sure.
And you know, there is still a place for you know, cash flowing, dividend paying companies.
Boring companies.
Yes, boring companies. And you know, interestingly enough, on the private side, that's another area where we're seeing value. Is you've got a lot of boomers that are retiring that have been operating a business. It's not huge, it's just got a little moat, a couple million in EBITDA. And there's no market for that because there's very few micro-cap PE funds that are out shopping.
Plus, you need an operator if they're looking to retire.
Exactly. So if you get a few partners, or if you have depth of people that you'd be able to bring in, or at least just do the HR search function to be able to find somebody who has the skill set, all of a sudden you can pick up these companies for 3-4 times cash flow.
Right. Probably with
not
the seller's note.
Three
as well.
Times revenue, not 182 times revenue.
Yeah.
Three times cash flow, right? You drop a little bit of leverage in there and you can get your equity back in dividends 18 months, 2 years.
That's traditional leverage buyout model that, you know, worked for KKR back when they first started, right?
It still works.
Yeah. Any firm that tries that, I mean, that's when those firms saw their best returns, was those boring investments, industrial companies that they can lever up a little bit and pay
or
a great cash flow.
Those.
Yeah.
KKR
or a lot, yes. But I mean, and the other side of that return though is also what you paid for it, right?
Exactly.
As these, there's so much private equity capital in dry powder that is out there that a lot of these larger firms are getting bidding wars between different private equity funds.
Oh, for sure.
And so all of a sudden they're paying 12 times, 14 times, underwriting a whole bunch of growth.
It's basically which private equity firm is willing to accept the lowest IRR for that investment.
Yeah. And so
curse.
That's actually one of the reasons we haven't been allocating to private equity funds.
Right.
We've been, aside from a couple of our partners that are running these microcap funds.
Right. So more so a proprietary deal flow that isn't necessarily subject to widely shopped potential bidding war between firms.
And that also provides us with co-investment opportunities too.
Right.
Right. And so all of a sudden we can pick up a bigger piece of some of these companies, but they're already tiny.
Yeah.
So it's a lot more appealing from just a recycling of capital standpoint, right?
So in terms of what you do, it really straddles a lot of different buckets. You know, it's not just plain vanilla VC investing. It's not just plain vanilla private equity investing. What I find interesting about what you're doing at Blue Sky is it's really across a bunch of different spaces. Which,
asset allocation.
Yeah. And so
I describe myself as a completely unconstrained portfolio manager.
Which is exactly what any portfolio manager dreams of, right? Right? Having the broadest mandate possible to generate returns. On that similar vein, and do seem quite contrarian, willing to not go with whatever is the sector du jour and things of that nature, who are some of the investors that you really admire, you really like to follow in terms of, you know, generating your own strategy?
You know, a lot of the guys who, where, how do I put that, that I mean, the timing was right, but that found something that was a secular trend that was occurring and were able to completely capitalize on it. Bill Gross and PIMCO, right? Yeah. He rode this multi-decade bull market in bonds.
His entire career. It's like it started when he started and retired, and you know, the rates went from 15% to sub-zero, and you mentioned the notion of luck, and there it is personified.
100%, right? Recognizing it and being able to ride it, and I mean, being good at it, like for a long time, he was the best bond fund on the planet, effectively, right? Jim Simons and Rentec, with the first sort of quant fund. Now there's a bunch of guys, anyone who's come out of data science, well, not anyone, but I've seen so many different pitches of people that have an algorithm, but being the first, you compound at 60% a year for 20 years, and that's generational wealth, right? Warren Buffett and value, Warren Buffett, everyone says Warren Buffett, but it's, There's something to be said from each of these areas, and they all focused on one versus what you said before. I'm unconstrained, and from a prudential standpoint, I need to have exposure to all the asset classes, just about, right? Struggling with fixed income, although the one area that that we're exploring right now is actually directly buying Chinese government bonds on the fixed income side.
What's the thesis behind that?
A couple of things. They're one of the few large bond markets in the world that still offers positive real returns. They've come out of the coronavirus pandemic having printed far less money.
Right.
And so you combine the lower money growth with higher yields, and it's pretty bullish on the yuan or the renminbi.
Right.
And then secondly, of course, you've got an actual yield.
Right.
Like you do get paid.
Yeah, it's a currency play combined with real interest rates being positive there, which in most places in the world, if not nominally negative, then, say in US and Canada, certainly negative on a real basis.
And, there's still, if we do wind up seeing, interest rates across the globe go to zero, well, you've got a lot more room for duration.
Sure.
Falling from, call it 3% to zero versus falling from 50 beeps to zero.
But do you think there's room in a portfolio for that currently? Say being long 30-year treasuries just, as a potential hedge?
We've been trading in and out of them all year, right? Effectively, equity markets have gotten too high, or we've seen a few different just random spikes in the U.S. 30-year that have come up to 1.7, 1.8. Mm-hmm. We'll pick it up, just sell it again at 1.3, buy it again at 1.7. We've been in and out of that trade probably three times this year.
So it's kind of range bound in terms of the yield on the 30-year.
The question of which direction it's going to go now that things have sort of settled. Mm-hmm. My thesis, how I would think, is that if we do get another significant equity market correction, then 30 years probably come, the yield probably comes down, so the price comes up. So there might be one last trade in there, but it's a little more worrisome now than it was, when we were picking them up in February in anticipation for the equity market correction.
Yeah, there's a bit more of a cushion there in case things didn't go your way. And with respect to interest rates going up, widowmaker trade that people have been predicting for a long time, but thus far it's, how low can things go? Or will yields go negative?
It's negative.
There's effectively no limit.
Yeah.
You see it in Europe and Japan, negative yields. Haven't seen it in North America yet, perhaps maybe slightly on short-term treasuries when things were really squirrely back in March, but certainly not on a sustained basis. Do you think that could potentially be in the cards?
Oh, for sure, right? Like to go back to our previous conversation around Bitcoin and the different aspects that could cause inflation or call it re-inflationary trends that are occurring. The whole money printing, universal basic income is something that's now on the radar, at least here in Canada, at a federal level.
For sure.
And again, the premise of economics is that money is something that is exchanged for goods or services, and there is value, and that's how you come to price discovery. Is this haircut I value at $30, but that even better haircut that's $60, it's not worth it for me, right? Everyone makes those decisions, and so they're parting with some of that money in exchange for providing something. If all of a sudden you've got a massive chunk of the population that's not providing these goods or services, that is inflationary.
Right.
And so, you know, you do wind up running a fairly significant risk that this money that is coming into the system is going to bid up the scarce goods and services that are being provided.
Right.
Right.
That's interesting because over the podcast, we've discussed a number of different asset classes, whether it's a VC type investments, early stage, in addition to small company leverage buyouts, which are obviously you're looking to produce market beating returns out of those. Touched on Bitcoin, which is more of a purchasing power maintenance type play. And then on the fixed income side, duration play, more of an insurance type trade. So if you were to summarize your asset allocation framework, how would you discuss it? What's the kind of underlying goal? We see all these different buckets with each one have a different goal. Is your overall framework just, you know, that diversification of uncorrelated return streams, or really what are you looking to achieve?
Yeah, so I mean, you can think of it like a all-weather portfolio, and the purpose is, again, like I can talk about inflation or tech bubbles or all this kind of stuff, but actually calling the top is also the Widowmaker trick, right? And so having, again, diversification, the whole point is to not be too levered towards any one specific outcome.
Right.
Right? And so what we try and do, and then the aspect of hedge fund allocations, which our primary focus there is on uncorrelated returns.
Right.
So who knows if it's going to go up or down with the market, and it doesn't matter. The whole point is just absolute returns, yeah. I would say, right? And so really that's what our shop is trying to do over, you know, the medium to long term,
right,
is generate absolute returns without taking undue risk in a portfolio context. Even though we're taking lots of risk on every individual trade, because you have to,
yeah,
if you want to make money.
Yeah.
The point is that if you've got a couple losers, you're going to have a couple more winners, and hopefully you've appropriately sized them so that the winners offer more absolute return, right?
So a lot of small bets that sort of offset.
Yeah.
And, you know, as long as you have more winners than losers, you guys will be good.
Exactly. And that's where the sizing comes in terms of the conviction too, right?
For sure.
When, for example, when you mentioned the VC side, so, and the issues with, say, with SoftBank and other, the world being awash in VC capital, where it is inflationary by nature, you offset some of that risk with, say, something such as your Bitcoin allocation, which you find areas within your portfolio to hedge off those bets, as well as you'd mentioned your Chinese bond allocation, where that's really a view on a relative view of Chinese bonds versus U.S. bonds. It really kind of brings back to when you first spoke about when you your very first days at Blue Sky, where you were just looking to hedge off the oil exposure in the portfolio. It's become, from an outsider's perspective, it's become a lot more sophisticated, but the underlying goals still somewhat remain the same.
Absolutely. And again, working for a single family office, one of the most difficult things when I first started is trying to move from the get-rich mindset, which is what successful entrepreneurs that have made enough money to have their own office to manage their assets still want to do, to a stay-rich mindset, where we're still able to indulge ourselves in highly risky investments from a portfolio context that isn't risky
As a whole. Yeah.
Or you know what I mean. Right. Less risky.
For sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mitigating the risk. One thing that I wanted to touch on, and you know, our mission at Accelerate is to democratize alternatives. You've discussed in the past the notion of democratizing venture capital. How do you view that playing out? What's your thesis behind that potential there?
Well, you know, I've talking about libertarian bents, I've always struggled with the whole aspect of accredited investors.
Yeah, me too.
And really limiting people's access to these asset classes that pensions and foundations...
Making the rich richer.
Yes. Well, I mean, again, unless you have a pension and you were invested in it, right? But for you know, the general public who have a advisor or that's only putting them in mutual funds or ETFs prior to, you know, Accelerate, your options were stocks and bonds,
right.
Maybe commodities, right?
Triple levered ETFs now, which for some reason anyone can buy, yet they can't allocate to, say, like a low risk hedge fund or something like that.
I can blow all my money on Tesla calls
exactly.
I really want to.
Yeah.
But, you know, putting it in a hedge fund?
Yeah.
No, not allowed because of the lack of liquidity, right? That at least the Tesla call, you can close your position tomorrow, right? And so I'd love to see more access to venture capital. You know, one of the things that I've thought about exploring is, you know, coming up with almost like a closed-end fund for venture capital that is index traded to get around the aspect of liquidity.
Right.
Obviously, it would trade at a discount to NAV, I would imagine, unless it's super hot or there's some type of news on the underlying companies. But one of the issues that there is that in the venture capital private company space, these companies often want to operate in stealth mode and not have their financials released, not have that much information out there. And if you've got a small closed portfolio that's publicly traded, there's certain disclosures that you have to have. And if all of your value is coming from investments in the underlying companies, you're going to have to provide some information there in order for people to be able to come up with a trading value, because unfortunately the NAV in that traditional context doesn't get marked to market very often.
Right.
The only time that you revalue a private security is if there's some type of liquidity event, or if they raise more capital at a set valuation or what have you, right? And so a really successful company that's growing within cash flow might not need to raise capital for a number of years. It's worth, you know, 5x, 10x, 20x more than what you originally invested in, but you don't have any real grounds to be able to mark that up, right? So you'd have to disclose that to investors, and in which case maybe the underlying company doesn't want that information out there. So it does offer a little bit of a conundrum, or it limits your investable universe only to companies that are comfortable having that information disclosed.
Or companies in which you can buy their shares either from them or from former employees, because I know that a lot of private cos don't like that either, right?
Yeah.
Which, you know, probably ties into your notion of not wanting to disclose certain amount of information.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, obviously there's struggles there. There's been a few crowdfunding platforms that are trying to allow individuals to write small checks, but in aggregate, raise reasonable amounts. The problem, of course, is the size, right? People can only put 5,000 in.
Yeah, I thought it was between 5,000 and 10,000, but this was years ago that I was looking at this.
But then the companies can only raise a $500,000. And it's like, well, you've got a pretty small project. If you're only limiting it to $500,000,
right?
And so, I mean, there's certain elements of scalability that you just sort of struggle with. But at the same time, if you are going to go for a $10 million Series A, and you got to take it in $5,000 bites,
a lot of checks to collect.
Right? That also causes problems.
Sure. So. Yeah. Interesting. So, Kevin, I want to put you on the spot here. If you could hold one investment for the next 10 years, what would it be?
Oh, let's...
Private, I think.
Any asset.
Yeah.
I probably stick with Bitcoin from the standpoint. So again, to go back to that whole inflation conversation we were having, might not happen for a few years.
Right.
It might take 2-5. I'd probably take the under on 10 though. And so from that standpoint, and just again, the level of knowledge surrounding Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and the amount, the ease with which people will be able to acquire it and that it'll become more of a staple, I think bodes pretty well for where its value will be in 10 years.
Right. Cool. Well, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. Prior to letting you go, is there anywhere where investors can follow you on Twitter, social media, anything like that, or you keep pretty secret?
You know, so Blue Sky Equities has a one page website. It is just a landing page.
Right.
To be honest, we just created our LinkedIn last month.
Okay.
So we're finally getting with the times. Flying under the radar has often been how we've managed, just so that we don't get too many unsolicited pitches.
For sure.
But following Blue Sky Equities on LinkedIn would probably be the best way to get
hold of us. Okay, cool. Well, there you have it, folks. Kim and Brent, Blue Sky Equities, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
My pleasure.
All right. Cheers, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.